the Green Beret active duty who shot himself and his Tesla, you could call it a tank, exploded in front of the Trump Hotel, as well as the Army veteran in New Orleans. These what look like lone wolf military guys, heavily armed. Did you see, as you were exploring this terrain with John Williams, people like that?
Yes. I mean, this is certainly, and it's not... you know, I don't want to get into specific incidents that we haven't reported, but I mean, there've been high profile, nothing like the Las Vegas attack, but high profile incidents in the 2022 midterms, for instance, of a man doing an armed stakeout of a ballot box and getting in a confrontation with a woman sparked a national news cycle. He was an AP3 leader. Doing an AP3 operation, and he was not linked back to the group or to any kind of organized effort until John came along. And so certainly these people right now may well be lone wolves. I have no reason to suggest otherwise. And there's, you know, people can be radicalized online right now. But there's also this long history of, and it's, I think, become an even more concerted effort potentially in recent years, of people committing acts of violence who look like lone wolves, take care to look like lone wolves, and then it comes out very long after the fact that they actually were working with or had a very long history with organized militia groups.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us and for doing this deep investigation. Joshua Kaplan, Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for ProPublica, who covered the January 6, 2021 insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, has a major new exposé. We'll link to it. It's headlined "The Militia and the Mole." When we come back, we speak with the acclaimed Palestinian poet Mossab Abu Toha, his latest piece in The New Yorker, Requiem for a Refugee Camp. Stay with us.
The state, the church, the plans, the way, the dead, the mind, the cut, what's the verb behind it all? The do, the how, the why, the where.
According to Nouns by Minutemen. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to Gaza, where Israeli forces are continuing their unrelenting attacks, killing scores of Palestinians, even as Israeli and Hamas officials resume talks in Qatar aimed at a ceasefire. Al Jazeera reports Israel carried out over 100 bombings over the weekend. According to Gaza's health ministry, 31 Palestinians were killed in the last 24 hours. The UN is warning its efforts to bring humanitarian aid into the besieged Gaza Strip are at a breaking point after Israeli forces opened fire on a World Food Program convoy over the weekend. Staffers documented at least 16 bullet holes in their aid convoy's three vehicles, saying the shooting left them terrified. More than 330 aid workers in Gaza have been killed since October 7, 2023, according to the United Nations. Overnight on Monday, Dr. Tabat Salim, a Palestinian neonatal doctor and volunteer at the Al-Aqsa Martyrs Hospital, was killed in an Israeli airstrike in the Nusayrat refugee camp. More than 1,000 healthcare workers have been killed in Israel's ongoing assault on Gaza, according to the Palestinian Health Ministry. Dr. Salim's killing follows the destruction of the Kamel Adwan Hospital, the last remaining hospital in northern Gaza over the weekend. The head of the World Health Organization's once again urged Israel to release Dr. Hossam Abu Safia, director of Kamel Adwan, from prison after he was arrested by Israeli forces along with other medical workers during a raid on December 27th. But Israel is not confirming that they have Dr. Safia. For more on the deteriorating situation in Gaza, we're joined in Syracuse, New York, by the acclaimed Palestinian poet Masab Abu Toha. His recent piece for The New Yorker magazine is headlined Requiem for a Refugee Camp, which focuses on Gaza's largest refugee camp, now in ruins, Jabalia. It's where his grandparents grew up. Masab Abu Toha, joining us from Syracuse. Thank you so much for joining us again, Masab. If you can talk about Jabalia and all of this latest news we're getting out of Gaza. You know, we spoke to you in Gaza when you were there with your family. We spoke to you after Rafat Al-Arir, your colleague, a fellow poet, was killed in an Israeli airstrike, professor at Islamic University. We spoke to you in Cairo when you just gotten out with your family. We spoke to you in New York here in the studio when your book came out, Forest of Noise. And now we're talking to you today, this utterly painful piece, Requiem for a Refugee Camp, that you've just published in The New Yorker. Talk about your experience and what the centrality of this camp.
Yeah, thank you so much, Amy, for the coverage. I mean, the painful thing is that we are talking about things today and next year would happen that we are talking about the same thing, the same losses, or even worse. So today is the anniversary of my friend Ma'ruf Al-Ashqar's killing. He was killed last year, and just 2 months ago, his father was killed in an airstrike. So today is his first anniversary. And we and the city Beit Lahia, which is next to Jabalia, the Jabalia refugee camp, is under the Israeli occupation. I mean, now when we talk about the Israeli occupation, we are no longer talking about settlements in the West Bank or, you know, or Palestinian cities occupied by Israel in 1948. But now we can talk about the Israeli occupation of the Gaza Strip, because not only did they expel people. And this is what I'm talking about in my piece about the refugee camp. Not only did they expel people, most people in the Jabalia refugee camp have been expelled by the Israeli occupation. They not only expelled these people, but they also blew up the houses in the refugee camp where people used to live for 70 or more years. I mean, the house where my maternal grandparents were born, where they grew up, where they had my mother and her siblings. This house does not exist anymore. And this is really a very devastating thing for refugees. The refugee camp is a place that should have been a temporary place for people. They should be living in the refugee camp until they could return to the houses of their grandparents or their parents or even their own houses in Yaffa, in Haifa, etc. But these people were expelled from the refugee camp. The refugee camp is destroyed, and these people are now living in other newly constructed refugee camps. And when we talk about refugee camps right now in Gaza, these are group of tents that do not protect people from the heat, do not protect people from the Israeli airstrikes. And we watched so many airstrikes that Israel carried out that were targeting tents, especially in the humanitarian zone. So the Jabalia refugee camp is the largest of the 8 refugee camps in the Gaza Strip. It was a home for about 120,000 people, all of them refugees from cities and villages close to the Gaza Strip. So it is a very devastating loss for people, not only to lose their friends, to lose their families, to lose their house, but also not to know whether they would be able to return to the refugee camp, which was supposed to be a temporary place. Just imagine, Amy, that you are expelled from your house in Yaffa in 1948, and then you live in a refugee camp, and then this same occupation comes and destroys the refugee camp. Now you are farther and farther from your dream of returning. Now you are dreaming of returning to the refugee camp. So this is really the tragedy of the Palestinian people right now.
This latest news that we have, we don't know where Dr. Abu Safia is. Many people know his name, head of Kamal Adwan Hospital, because he has been reporting on the conditions of the hospital. And now Israel is saying they don't have him. People are saying they saw him taken away. How is it that his lawyers cannot see him? You have the World Food Program, the UN organization, their convoy fired upon. The number of health medical personnel, from doctors to nurses to hospital staff, who've been killed in Gaza. Talk about the significance of this and what these hospitals meant for you when you lived in Gaza with your children and your wife.
So, Amy, really, really, something that really devastates my heart is that we are watching these things happening as we are talking. I mean, we have the news that Dr. Hatem Abu Safia was abducted from inside the hospital. We saw the hospital where he was working burned and turned into ashes. And we saw the news about the Hind Rajab family and Hind Rajab herself. And we saw doctors and journalists being targeted and killed. So we have all this news, and nothing is changing the world in terms of taking action against Israel, punishing it. Not only, I mean, they did not get the Palestinians their rights, you know, that are guaranteed by international law after 1948, but they are now watching a genocide being perpetrated by the same occupation, which was admitted to the United Nations just 1 year after it was established. Just imagine that it took Israel 1 year to become a member, a full member of the United Nations. And now it's been taking the whole world about 15 months, and we don't know for how many more. It's been taking them a long time even to stop Israel from perpetrating this well-documented genocide. And I would like, Amy, to draw your attention that 1 day after the Israeli army or the Israeli forces denied their position of Dr. Hatem Safia, 1 day later, the Israeli military spokesperson issued a statement that Dr. Hatem Abu Safia is with the Israeli army, and he is interrogated because he is suspected of being a Hamas member. So this was one thing that was issued 1 day after they denied their having Dr. Hatem Abu Safia. So, I mean, this tells you that Israel, whenever they are under pressure, they will succumb. They will change their minds. They will say, oh, we have him, and he's under interrogation. He's a suspected Hamas general. He's a Hamas general. He's not even Hamas. He's not only Hamas. He's a Hamas general. He's a very, very big guy in Hamas, you know, a doctor who's working with the patients, who refused to leave them, who was injured, whose son was killed. He could leave Gaza any day because he has a Kazakhstani citizenship. And I would like to draw your attention to another thing, which is that the director of Al Auda Hospital, Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, has been abducted by the Israeli forces from inside the Al Auda Hospital for 350 days. And there is no information about this doctor. I mean, the world started to pay attention and to advocate on behalf of Dr. Hatem Safia because, you know, he had some reports. He had an Instagram page. He has been talking about the situation. So people knew him. So that's why people want him to be out, you know, because they feel like they knew him in person. But this Dr. Ahmed Mhanna, and this is the case of about hundreds of other people, these people, no one knows about them. You know, we haven't seen, I mean, I've never seen Dr. Ahmed Mhanna. I've never seen a video of him. But he's a doctor. He's the director of the Al Auda Hospital, and he's been abducted for about 350 days, about a year. And there is no news about him, and no one talks about him. And this is the case of so many people that we don't know about until they are dead, just like Dr. Adnan Al-Bursh. He was abducted from the same hospital, Al Auda Hospital. And the people paid attention to him when he died, and people, yes. I mean, we don't want to die. We don't want to suffer for people or for governments to sympathize with us and say, we need him, bring him back. He is innocent. No, everyone in Gaza is innocent. Everyone in Gaza has been living this hell by Israel for decades, not for 15 months.
Musab Abu Toha, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Palestinian poet and author. We'll link to your piece in The New Yorker, Requiem for a Refugee Camp. He's the author of the award-winning poetry collection, Things You May Find Hidden in My Ear, Poems from Gaza. His latest book is called Forest of noise. Up next, we look at President Carter's legacy in Latin America with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Greg Grandin. But first, we'll play a clip of President Clinton, of President Carter, when I interviewed him at the Carter Center in Atlanta.
Never went down to Georgia. He was looking for a soul to steal. He was in a bind because he was way behind and he was willing to make a deal. When he came across this young man sawing on a fiddle and playing it hot, and the devil jumped up on a hickory stump and said, "Boy, let me tell you what. I guess you didn't know it, but I'm a fiddle player too. And if you'd care to take a dare, I'll make a bet with you. Now you play pretty good fiddle, boy, but give the devil his due. I bet a fiddle of gold against your soul because I think I'm better than you." The boy said, "My name's Johnny, and it might be a sin, but I'll take your bet and you're going to regret because I'm the best there's ever been." "Johnny, rosin up your bow and play your fiddle hard, because hell's broke loose in Georgia and the devil deals the cards. And if you win, you get this shiny fiddle made of gold, but if you lose, the devil gets your soul." Up his case and he said, "I'll start this show and fire
the Charlie Daniels Band." This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The remains of President Jimmy Carter arrive in Washington, D.C. today, where he'll be honored by a ceremony at the U.S. Capitol before lying in state through Thursday morning. The casket carrying the 39th American president will leave the Carter Presidential Center in Atlanta, where thousands of mourners paid their respects over the weekend, and travel to Dobbins Air Reserve Base north of Atlanta before arriving at Joint Base Andrews in Maryland with a motorcade into Washington, D.C. His casket will be carried into the Capitol Rotunda for an afternoon service with members of Congress, after which the public can pay respects. President Carter's state funeral will take place at the National Cathedral in Washington Thursday, which President Biden has declared a national day of mourning. President Carter died December 29th at the age of 100. We interviewed him a number of times on Democracy Now! This is a short clip of an interview I did with him when I went down to Atlanta to the Carter Center in 2007. These views are much less often being referred to as President Carter is being talked about and eulogized. We were talking about his book, Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid.
Americans don't want to know, and many Israelis don't want to know what is going on inside Palestine. It's a terrible human rights persecution that is far transcends what any outsider would imagine. And there are powerful political forces in America that prevents any objective analysis of the problem in the Holy Land.
That's the late president on Palestine. For the full interview and our other interviews with President Carter, you can go to democracynow.org. Today, we look at President Jimmy Carter's legacy in Latin America with Greg Grandin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author of The End of the Myth, From the Frontier to the Border Wall in the Mind of America, professor of history at Yale University. His forthcoming book, America, America, A New History of the New World, which will be out in April. If you can first, before we get into Panama, because it was under President Carter that Panama Canal was returned to Panama, the oversight of it, and before we talk about Salvador and Nicaragua, overall, President Carter's legacy in Latin America?
Well, I think it was mixed and it was confused. I mean, Carter was in many ways a transitional president that came to power having to deal with the combined disasters of both Vietnam and Watergate and rebuild trust and rebuild the kind of moral foundation on which the United States justified its exercise of power. And in many ways, Latin America was the place to do that. I mean, just to set the stage a little bit, set the scene. Carter comes to power, and he's inaugurated in 1977. Pretty much all of South America is run by anti-communist dictatorships that were installed or supported by the United States. The Nixon Doctrine, coups under Lyndon B. Johnson, coups under Kennedy. They brought to power one anti-communist dictatorship after another, largely in response to the Cuban Revolution, backing up even further. In Central America, they weren't dictatorships, but they were insurgencies, revolutionary insurgencies, and anti-communist states fighting those insurgencies. And domestically, you had a very anti-imperialist Congress elected after Watergate and after Vietnam that insisted that the United States start pulling back some of its support for dictatorships, for more of its unsavory allies. And Latin America seemed the place to do it. And they did. They cut aid to Uruguay. They cut aid to They limited aid to Chile. They cut aid to Brazil. All the military to Argentina, and of course that became a kind of shining example of what the United States should be in terms of its foreign policy. The reality was actually more complicated. It was also the place where the United States started putting conditionalities on military aid. And obviously we see that under Gaza, how that's played out. But that the United States would, you know, there would be certain markers or certain check marks that countries had to meet in terms of human rights monitoring before military aid was released. In many ways, it was more symbolic than real. In a country like Guatemala, for instance, where the United States did cut off military aid, it didn't cut off military aid that was already in the pipeline, so that continued to flow. Now, in Central America, where you had insurgencies, these were kind of like a stress test for this new foreign policy, this new moralism that Jimmy Carter represented. And he didn't at first cut aid off to Nicaragua, and he didn't cut off aid to El Salvador.
Meaning in Nicaragua to Somoza.
To Somoza or to the junta in El Salvador.
Now, let's talk about El Salvador, yeah. Because you have Archbishop Oscar Romero, who has been canonized a saint by the Vatican, who was assassinated on March 24th, 1980. He appealed to President Carter weeks before his assassination to stop the flow of aid.
Directly, in a very impassioned letter I teach that letter, and Carter didn't respond. He left it to Cyrus Vance to respond. He didn't respond, and they didn't cut off aid. And even prior to that, Cyrus Vance was Carter's Secretary of State. Brzezinski was his National Security Advisor, and in many ways you can think of them as two sides, like Vance was considered more dovish and Brzezinski more hawkish, a little bit more complicated than that. But Brzezinski was complaining to the Vatican about Oscar Romero, that he had been moved too far to the left. This was before the letter. So you see that, it's not just Jimmy Carter, it's the administration he presides over. It's much more.
When Oscar Romero was giving his homily that was broadcast throughout El Salvador, when he was gunned down, he was appealing to the soldiers of El Salvador, to the paramilitaries. He said, I beseech you, I urge you, I plead yeah. with you to put down your arms.
Yeah. That was a day before he was assassinated. He was assassinated in a smaller church. It was a smaller mass in a smaller parish in San Salvador. He was shot through the heart. By a death squad that was trained by the United States and led by Roberto Del Bisson.
He would later become
the head of the Arena Party. I don't believe he was president, but no, he became the head of the party that ruled El Salvador, the Arena Party. But he became a very influential politician, Roberto Del Bisson.
Right, he was a member of the Legislative Assembly.
Yeah, and he was a favorite of the far right. So Jimmy Carter, in many ways, is a foil for the rising right in the United States, and his policies in Latin America kind of captured the contradictions and I would use the word contradiction rather than confusion of Carter's foreign policy. You know, he came to power. He gave us, you know, when he came to power, promising to end the United States' inordinate fear of communism. He gave a speech in Notre Dame that was considered a kind of a new kind of doctrine, that the United States was moving away from both the ideological excess and the support for dictatorships that led to wars like Vietnam or coups in Chile. Events got ahead of him in many ways. In Central America, the rise of the Sandinistas and insurgencies led to contradictory policies. In El Salvador, he for instance, continued supporting the military regime and its dead squads. In Nicaragua, he cut off economic aid, but he continued military aid as he tried to kind of guide, force Somoza out and lead to more democratic elections. But the Sandinistas had the momentum. There was the Iranian Revolution in the Persian Gulf, which led to the Carter Doctrine, which was written by Brzezinski and basically asserted that the United States would respond with military force to anything that they perceived as a threat to U.S. interests.
I want to play a clip of President Carter's commencement speech at the University of Notre Dame in 1977.
Democracy's great recent success in India, Portugal, Spain, Greece, show that our confidence in this system is not misplaced. Being confident of our own future, we are now free of that inordinate fear of communism, which once led us to embrace any dictator who joined us in that fear.
So that was President Carter, the significance of what he was saying there when it relates to, for example, Latin America.
Well, that he was saying that he was going to deal with third world nationalism on its own terms, not as just a front for geopolitical Cold War politics, meaning the Soviet Union. But that gives way very quickly. I mean, we only have a few minutes, but we have to say that it was under Carter that the CIA began its operation in Afghanistan, began supporting the Mujahideen. It was the Carter administration in July 1979, urged by Brzezinski, to begin providing non-lethal aid to what becomes the Mujahideen. All of these things led to what the end of detente and the pulling of the Soviet Union deeper into Afghanistan and the weaponization of Islam as a geopolitical tool in the United States that we're still living with the consequences today. And for all of his decency and humanity, especially compared to the the wealth and the clown circus that we're living under now, we have to kind of look at how Carter, some of the more unfortunate legacies of Carter's administration.
Now, President Carter did sign an agreement in 1977 to gradually return control of the Panama Canal to Panama. This came after mass protests in Panama wanting the return of their canal. Talk about the significance of this deal, and now we go full circle as President Trump threatens to take it back, and the flags will fly at half staff during the inauguration, something President Trump has decried, saying it's the first time, because Biden has called for flags to fly at half staff for the 30 days after Carter's death.
Yes, the return of Panama was a huge symbolic and material correction of an injustice. Panama was a province of Colombia. The United States, Teddy Roosevelt, teamed up with J.P. Morgan to basically, coax a revolution there, an insurgency, and recognize the independence of Panama, and then built a canal and that the United States controlled, the Panama Canal Zone, and Carter's return of it. It was very symbolic.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. Pulitzer Prize-winning author, professor of history at Yale University, Greg Grandin. And finally today, our deepest condolences to Democracy Now!'s Juan Gonzalez on the passing of his mother, Florinda Guillen. She was 97 years old. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dean Augusta, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Anjali Kamat, Trina Nadurasa, Malkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karen, Hani Masood, and Hannah Elias. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
My name is Eric Swanson, and I'm a dad of two young girls. It was a game changer when we learned that $10 a day childcare was being offered to both our kids. And we want all BC families to have this option. To get there, BC has to do three key things. Pay fair and consistent wages for all childcare educators. Transition all existing programs to $10 a day. And plan childcare expansion more like we do schools and hospitals. BC's on the right track, but we need to go faster. Go to 10aday.ca to learn more.